welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet and Ann Burnham, joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. I am doing great. First day of the semester, but we're both on leave at the moment, so we're happy boys.
Yeah, and you are headed back to Charlottesville tomorrow.
So this is our last episode
together, at least for a little bit.
But we will be joined together by the magic of the internet. It's going to be huge.
It's a new thing. Right, so we are now in day 21, if I'm counting correctly.
I think it's 23.
Anyway. I'm not very good with contemporary dates anyway.
Okay.
We are now several weeks into
it's the longest shutdown ever.
Yes, the longest shutdown ever of the federal government. And we're also at the beginning of the 2020 presidential campaign cycle. And what do these things have in common? I think something they have in common is they're both tied up with presidential promises. That in some ways the shutdown, I think, is a consequence of Trump pledging during the campaign in 2016 to build the wall. And he's trying to fulfill that promise. His 2020 campaign slogan, Frank, have you heard of what it is?
No.
Promises kept. Which I guess he means he's going to hopefully keep a promise, at least for the Trump supporters, before Election Day in 2020.
Right, okay.
So, and we have Elizabeth Warren
I'm interrupting your intro, which is really rude, but say what you will about Trump, and we have. He does, or the people around him are good at slogans. So if you think about it, Make America Great Again is a deeply problematic slogan, and we've discussed why for historical reasons and other, but it's a very compelling distillation of what he was running on. And promises kept works too.
He is, if anything, good at branding.
Yes, anyway, so...
But we also have all kinds of people throwing their hat in the ring for the Democratic nomination, who will presumably also be making promises in the campaign. So we thought we'd talk about the history of campaign promises, which ones get kept, which ones don't get kept, what are the consequences if you make a promise in the campaign and don't follow through or can't follow through.
Because most famously, we're in this shutdown. No, sorry, most immediately, I should say. We're in the shutdown at the moment over the promise he made about building the wall on the southern border.
Exactly. So let's go back to the beginning, Frank. When we talked about the sort of the founding generation, did they make campaign promises? And if so, did they keep them?
In a word, no. Because, as you know, David, the nature of politics was different in the late 18th and early 19th century. Although one stood for office, one didn't run for office. And the distinction's important. So, well, the founding generation, for example, were very, very ambitious and capable of cutthroat politics. It wasn't politics necessarily as we know it, which is really a product of a more democratic system where you have to curry public favor in some way. So I think the most famous, so they don't make campaign promises in the same way that we've come to know and we'll see from some later examples in the next few minutes. The one that sticks out a little bit in my mind, but that's because the election itself was anomalous, was a promise Jefferson is, it's always Jefferson with me, right, is said to have made during the election controversy of 1800-1801. As many of our listeners will know, but some may not, in the election of 1800, the election of 1800 was not conclusive. It went to the House of Representatives to decide as mandated by the Constitution. And so during the winter of 1800-1801, there was a lot of kind of backstage drama between the two candidates who theoretically represented the same party, Jefferson and Aaron Burr. Over who would be president, and the outgoing, that is, Federalist-dominated House of Representatives was going to decide that election in February of 1801. And it is said that Jefferson promised to basically keep some of the key elements of Alexander Hamilton's fiscal program, a fiscal program which he detested, at least based on his earlier statements, in order to secure the support he needed in the House of Representatives. The records for this are opaque at best. It's not entirely clear that Jefferson made this promise, except to say that after he was elected in February of 1801 and inaugurated in March, he did actually maintain and more of the Federalist fiscal program and architecture than expected.
So that's a promise not made to the electorate, but to a handful of Federalist politicians.
Yes, that's right. So it's not a promise in the sense that I think we envision talking about campaign promises in today's episode. I think you don't get one of those, or you can't really have one of those until you have a bigger electorate. And of course, after the age of Jackson in the 1830s, we get the oxymoronic universal manhood suffrage, which is not universal because it excludes women and a large number of men in America, that is African Americans and Native Americans. Nonetheless, there's a turn towards popular democracy that begins in the 1830s and continues to the present, which requires candidates in some way, shape, or form to make promises to appeal to the electorate. So, David, when do you think we get the first kind of important campaign promise in American history?
So I think the most of what we're going to talk about this episode are 20th century things, because that seems to be a much more common tradition in the 20th century. But there's one mid-19th century example I think is really telling, and that is in the election of 1844, where James K. Polk, who is the Democratic nominee, promises several things were he to be elected. He promises to annex Texas. This has been one of the major divisive political issues. He pledges to exert the American claims in the Pacific Northwest and Oregon, where there was a territorial dispute with Great Britain over exactly where the United States ended and where British Canada began. And he also promised to only hold office for one term. And this was somewhat anomalous in making these kinds of explicit pledges during the campaign. And I think there's a couple of things that are leading to this. One is the democratization, as you mentioned, of the electorate. Two, I think we've got a ability of the candidate to communicate to a wider audience the spread of the penny press, the sort of democratization of media that happens in the Jacksonian period, where you can communicate these ideas to a broader audience easily and relatively inexpensively. And I think a third factor is we do have a divisive issue, this annexation of Texas, one where you either have to be for or against it, and Henry Clay, his opponent in that election, comes out against the annexation of Texas, and Polk comes out in favor.
To some extent, Clay also makes a promise, doesn't he? Yes. He says, I will not annex Texas. Exactly,
yes. Although he pushes that less strongly than that, he brands himself less strongly with that than Polk does. And I think the final reason is Polk makes these promises because Polk is a relatively unknown politician compared to most of the other people who had run for political office or for the presidency prior to that point. He had been born in North Carolina, been governor of Tennessee, but was not widely known. And so by linking himself with these issues, be saying, here, why should you vote for me? Because I will give you, in a sort of a transactional way, I will give you this if you vote for me. Whereas I think most of the two generations of politicians before him ran on their reputations as politicians, as military leaders, much more so than on a specific platform of issues. And so Polk's, needed to do that in order to have a kind of standing with the populace that, say, Henry Clay, who was his opponent. Henry Clay was extraordinarily well known. He was the father, really, of the Whig Party. When people go in to vote for Henry Clay, they kind of know who Henry Clay is because they've been working with Henry Clay. He's been in the public's eye since the War of 1812 at this point. Whereas Polk was a relatively unknown commodity. So he needed to latch himself to these promises. And the remarkable thing about Polk's promises is he kept all of them. If you're actually grading presidents based on what did they promise to do and how successful were they, Polk, I think, arguably gets an A, because he promised a bunch of things and he did all of them. Whether you agree with whether those things were good ideas or not, it's a different question. But
you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. David Silkenat, great admirer of James K. Polk.
No,
you're gonna miss me, David, aren't you?
you're not going anywhere. Just cross the nation. Yeah, but I mean, I think in terms of delivering to its constituents, yeah, you know, if he had gone against his pledge to only hold one term, he probably could have been reelected, because he really did, you know, deliver on his promises. But I think the big issue, you know, this whole idea of a campaign pledges does really come to the fore in the 20th century, where you find politicians promising a lot more to voters in exchange for their support. And I think, you know, the democratization of media that happens, you know, in a series of waves in the 20th century, the rise of radio and the rise of television, make those promises that much more important. The rise of primaries, where you have to sort of lay out stakes fairly early and consistently, you know, the rise of the modern campaign makes these campaign promises a much more of a 20th century artifact than they are something that appears very often in the 19th century. There are lots of politicians in the 19th century who stand for office as they would have in the revolutionary era, don't say much of anything about any of the big issues beyond what their campaign, their party platform was, assuming that the voters already know who they are and what they stand for without making specific concrete promises to them. In the 20th century, who do we think delivered on their promises? Who can we sort of say, here's a president who ran for something and on a particular issue or particular pledge and delivered?
Well, Eisenhower promised to go to Korea.
Which he did.
So actually, if you're going to make a promise like that, make it a straightforward one that you can easily accomplish.
Right.
So that's one that comes to mind, because there are some others. I'm trying to think of, well, Nixon claimed to have a secret plan to end the war.
So he could promise something but not tell anybody what it is.
The secret plan was to subvert the Constitution and be forced to resign. I'm trying to think. I mean, the most notable promises of the 20th and now 21st century seem to be those that were not kept.
It may be that
basically unkept promises are the ones we remember, and kept promises are a bit like party platforms. Mm. We don't remember them necessarily.
To be sure.
I'm trying to think. You know, so famously in 1916, Woodrow Wilson runs on a promise that he will keep the United States out of the First World War.
Yeah.
And famously, he brings the United States into the First World War.
Now, I don't think he paid a political cost for that, though, right?
Well, I think that's a different question.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just talking about promises made or kept or not.
Well, but one of the, you know, thinking about the ways in which the American public hears these promises in the campaign, you know, and there's the question of, do they expect this person to actually carry through what they say, and will they hold them responsible for when they don't? You know, I think, you know, if someone were to have asked Wilson, you know, in 1917, you said you would keep us out of war, now we're in a war, how do you explain that? I think Wilson's response would be, I said I would keep us out of war in the situation we were in 1916. The situation has changed, and therefore we're going to do different, I'm going to do different things based on new evidence and new, you know, a new situation on the ground. And so I think there isn't a political cost for him in promising something then changing when the situation does change. I mean, I think he's have a similar thing with George W. Bush in 2000, where throughout the campaign he said, no nation building, we're going to not get the United States involved in foreign conflicts, which is something that he does for the first 9 months of his, 8 months of his presidency, until 9/11 happens. And then all of a sudden, you know, the situation fundamentally changes, and Bush's ideas about nation building fundamentally change with it. And voters didn't seem to hold him like account for that, where they said, you said no nation building, you're doing nation building. He would say Osama bin Laden, 9/11, and that seemed to work with voters in 2004.
Yes, I mean, although I think it is interesting, you're absolutely right about that. And so circumstances do matter, and we do, I think, want presidents who adapt to changing circumstances. So when Bush, running in 2000, pledged no nation building, he had Somalia in mind, and basically the United States getting involved in a conflict that resulted in the on a relatively small basis, but the deaths of a considerable number of American soldiers,
yes.
And in circumstances that seemed unnecessary, didn't seem to be vital to the strategic interests of the United States. You're absolutely right. Post 9/11, that equation changes. Although even then, when the Bush administration engaged in or undertook the wars in Afghanistan and then later Iraq, they still hewed to somewhat to this rhetoric of no nation building. Although they did engage in nation building, they tried to do it kind of on the down low and on the cheap because they still felt that there was no real, not necessarily an appetite for it within the United States. And I think to some extent, some of the problems that the United States has faced in the international arena in the past now 18 years is a result of adhering a little bit to this no nation building mantra. I don't know how you feel about it. I mean, well, slightly off our topic, I realize.
No, but I think trying to figure out the role of the United States in the world and trying to sort of position yourself to make claims about, you know, what role the United States will take in the world is very tricky, because it's one of the things, foreign policy, that the president is both deeply involved in, and on the other hand, it's the thing they have almost the least control over. They have the power to change U.S. policy, but they don't have the ability to affect the policy changes that are happening in the other 200 nations in the world. Yeah. And so their ability to predict what could happen, would happen, should happen, especially during the campaign when they don't have access to all the confidential, top secret stuff that they'll get access when they're in the White House. I mean, I think there's lots of people who have foreign policy ideas when they're running for office, and then they get into the Oval Office, and it looks different from there.
Yes, we're back. Eisenhower's pledge, "I'll go to Korea," is a relatively easy promise to keep,
yes.
As opposed to saying, "Well, Wilson, I'll keep you out of war," or, you know, no nation building. I mean, it's interesting. All three of those are foreign policy at some level. Wilson's is the Eisenhower's is the simplest and frankly the most symbolic. It's a symbolic gesture, really.
And one that he couldn't, think about these promises. Engaging in a promise about foreign policy is something the president can do without the other branches of government.
Right? Yes,
so that's obviously right. The big conflict at the moment is the president has made a promise during the campaign to build the wall, and I think as he recently tweeted, the thing that Democrats don't understand is that elections have consequences, and the Democrats' response was, yes, elections do have consequences, and we won the last one. Building the wall is much more complicated than getting on a plane and flying to Korea.
So what are some of the other failed promises of the 20th? I mean, we'll get to the recent past in a few minutes, but just to give some historical context.
There's some where people have made promises and no one seems to have held them to him. I mean, one of the few things FDR said specifically during the campaign in 1932, during the Great Depression, was that he'd balance the budget. He said, "We'll have a New Deal. That's great. And we'll balance the budget." And they did one and not the other. But doing the New Deal requires not balancing.
One precluded the other, really.
Exactly. And now part of, thinking about what lots of successful politicians do is they make promises that are so general that they can say they fulfilled them no matter what they do. I mean, part of the problem with the wall as a promise is it is a very concrete, or steel slats, depending on, promise. Whereas, promising a New Deal or a fair deal or a great society, the specifics of what those mean, you can, proclaim mission accomplished, to mix another historical allusion, depending on what it is you get done and what the specifics of it matter. Thinking about other big ones that are failures, I think 64, LBJ, promising to keep the United States out of further involvement in Vietnam. And he has some quotation about, he's not going to send American boys to do what Asian boys should be doing. Turns out in the aftermath of that is a real election or re-election, the U.S. involvement in Vietnam increased dramatically.
And interestingly, in terms of promises kept or not kept and dealing with the consequences thereof, that breaking that promise pretty much is what led him to withdraw in 1968.
I think that's right. you know, and he could, you know, I think he tried to claim that the situation had changed and, you know, Gulf of Tonkin resolution and all that other kinds of stuff. But we're, you know, you're, one of the things about the 20th century and the kind of media landscape of the 20th century is people can look at the videotape or, you know, of him saying, I'm not doing this, and then you can juxtapose that with what's actually happening 2 or 3 years later.
Yes, if you're standing on the back of a railroad, on the platform on the back of a railroad car,
yeah.
In the late 19th or early 20th centuries, and you make a promise, the press may or may not report it, but it's not indelibly imprinted on the popular consciousness the way saying it on television is.
Yeah, and probably the most famous one, thinking about ones on television, in 1980, I guess 1988, George Herbert Walker Bush promised at the Republican convention, no new taxes.
Read my lips.
No new taxes. And, you know, he clearly wanted that to be a memorable note in that speech.
It was.
and, you know, when a couple of years later, he signed a new tax bill, which created new taxes, you know, people could point to that, and I think it caused dissension within his own party about his own promises.
Yeah, let me ask you something, David. Is that arguably the most important broken promise? And let me explain why, or the reasoning behind that question, which is after that, it became impossible for any Republican politician to favor a tax rise because Bush lost in 1992 as a result of breaking that promise. Now, there are lots of reasons why he lost in 1992, but that was certainly near the top of the list, or certainly that became the received wisdom. And as a consequence, it's put the Republican Party on a kind of fiscal path that's been very difficult for it to get off, with great consequences both for the party, but also for the United States. Now, I think Trump's promise to build a wall, depending on how the Trump presidency plays out, might be of even greater significance, but let's set that aside for the time being. But excluding Trump's pledge, is that the most significant broken promise?
Well, I think you're right that there's a, you know, that broken promise had long-term consequences in terms of Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution of 94, in terms of Grover Norquist and the, you know, tax pledges that he makes people sign now, in terms of thinking about sort of the trajectory between Bush's failure in 1992 and then the most recent Trump tax cut. The other sort of recent one that strikes me as a promise that became an albatross was Obama's pledge during the campaign in 2008 to close Guantanamo, because that had been the opening of a extraterritorial prison camp on Guantanamo Bay, a military base in Cuba, was, you know, one of the essential promises he made in this campaign. He tried very, very hard to get that get it closed, but due to Republican opposition in Congress and difficulties in finding new places to put these prisoners, it made it very difficult, you know. I think that sort of hung on his entire presidency for 8 years, the fact that he left the Oval Office, you know, 8 years later with Guantanamo Bay still open.
I think that's true. I agree with you completely. And in fact, I think that's the closest analog to Trump's wall. Because in both cases, the actual pledge itself was as much symbolic. I mean, I supported the closure of Guantanamo Bay, but they ended up transferring most of the prisoners out of it eventually, or sending them back to their countries of origin. It was a complicated story, as you know, and essentially Republican senators blocked that. And they blocked it simply because President Obama was in favor of it.
Yes.
And they did not want to give him that victory. Similarly, because President Trump is so invested in his wall, which has caused the shutdown of the government now, Democrats are similarly, and in fact with Guantanamo in mind, I suspect, unwilling to give an inch on it, because they don't, because basically the only political upside is for them, or sorry, of giving in would be for Trump, as they see it. and therefore they're unwilling to do so. So I think the wall is to Trump what closing Guantanamo was for President Obama, and I think the opposition therefore is responding in a similar fashion. Now I think that opposition is correct in their opposition to the wall, whereas it was wrong both politically and morally in terms of opposing the closing of Guantanamo. But I'm just revealing my own political biases,
which I share. But they're both in some ways, deeply symbolic gestures.
Right.
But they're also very specific and concrete things. You can either have a prison camp on Guantanamo or not. You can't say it's like mostly closed.
No, that's right. They did mostly close it.
Right. And either you build the wall or you don't build the wall or steal slots or whatever it is that they're thinking of now. But on the other hand, like, there are lots of politicians who make promise, even Trump, thinking about the last presidential race, where he made promises for things that he hasn't delivered on, and it hasn't weighed on him in the same way that the wall has.
So what do you have in mind?
Well, the lock her up pledge. As far as I know, Hillary Clinton is still meandering the forest and woods somewhere in Connecticut.
No, Chautauqua, New York.
No, Chautauqua. she's going to roam a lot. She's got
she's got time.
Yes, and lots of thinking to do. That was the two big chants in his campaign rallies were build the wall, lock her up, and the lock her up kind of disappeared on election day.
Well, when Michael Flynn got locked up, he was the kind of lead locker up guy. That might have taken some of the air out of that. Plus, I don't think, well, you're right, and it's interesting that they both resonated with the public. I think locker up was a shorthand for the kind of misogyny directed towards Hillary Clinton, as well as the animus towards the Clintons themselves. And I think that at some level, even the people chanting it recognized it was unlikely to happen. Whereas the wall, as you said, joking aside, is a concrete thing. It's a very specific thing. And he kept saying, we are going to build this wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. And he said that a million times. Yeah. They said lock her up as well, but lock her up almost became like a football chant. It was just what they said. It was I think that was a less specific promise. But you're right, he promised all kinds of things.
Promised a Muslim ban, which he tried to do.
Yeah. But the wall was the signature thing.
The wall is the signature thing, and the wall is the thing that requires Congress's consent.
Yes, it's interesting, because in both the case of Obama and Guantanamo and Trump and the wall, these are the signature promises that came to represent more than the actual issue.
Mm-hmm.
But they both required cooperation from Congress.
Yeah. Well, and thinking about the other promises you made, you repeal Obamacare, which they've tried to do but not really done, and have now, I think, apparently given up on repealing it entirely.
But they have gutted it.
They've gutted it, but it's still kicking at least a little bit. He promised a tax cut, which he delivered
on that. Promised Supreme Court justice
and delivered on that. So maybe the promise is kept. He'll be selective about which of the promises he's going to emphasize keeping.
Of course.
Now, thinking about Democrats who are putting their hats in the ring for 2020, and there's
several already,
and there will be several more probably by the time we release this podcast.
Have you declared yet, David?
I think I'm going to wait this one out. It's not my cycle. Would you recommend that they make campaign promises or not? What's the advantages of making these kinds of specific pledges?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I thought about something you said earlier, which is the introduction of the primary system in the late, during the progressive era. Encourages this because you have to fight within your own party to establish a space. And as a consequence, you have to win people over in your party. And the party faithful, which is another word for the base, which often requires making promises, or either explicit or implicit. Mm. So the Democrats at the moment have a bit of wind in their sails, but they have shifted to the left in terms of at least the Congressional Democratic Party. And, you know, we've seen young Democrats, you know, new faces who are really exciting people and putting a lot, you know, whether it's Beto O'Rourke or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who are really energizing the base. Mm. And that's going to require, and they may require candidates to make promises in order to win their support. So it's going to be very interesting. When the party out of power has a nomination fight, it often results in promises. Whether they should is another matter.
Well, I think that
you have to win over the whole electorate.
I mean, I think it speaks to why Trump was successful in 2016. You know, there was a very crowded Republican field. There were 20 candidates or something initially. And the fact that he had some very specific promises that translated well into...
That, again, were simple.
They were simple, and you could make a chant out of them and, you know, internet memes out of... that worked to his advantage, you know. And I think in the Democratic primary, there looks like there's going to be an equally crowded field, which is going to sort of also require people to distinguish themselves in some ways. Thinking back to the James K. Polk example, one of the thinking about the role then of having a crowded field and the necessity of promises there. Polk is one of the, I think, the first case of a dark horse candidate getting a party nomination when the Democrats met to select a candidate. There were a bunch of people in 1844 who thought they should be president. You know, Van Buren thought he should hold office again. Louis Cass thought he should be president. And there was but James Buchanan was up for briefly, was in the running. And you know, there was, I think they were on the 9th or 10th ballot when they selected Polk. You know, and I think part of that was, you know, how do you get somebody to gravitate towards an unknown candidate and distinguish him? It's by making specific promises. Here's a historical footnote. Do you know who put James K. Polk's name in nomination?
I do not.
George Bancroft.
Really? The historian?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Huh. Interesting.
That will be useful pub trivia never.
If we ever go to the pub where that is useful trivia, I suspect it will be a very quiet pub. but going back to your question of whether candidates should make promises and thinking about 2020, what's your response to that?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom is you should avoid making promises because they can get held against you, right? You should present a vision of things, a set of issues that are important to you, you know, and maybe have specific policy things buried in some, you know, policy statement that nobody reads. I mean, if you read, like, Hillary Clinton had more policy statements on everything that nobody read in the last election. But if she were she to have won that election, no one would have held her to any of those things. Obama, when he ran, you know, he made a few specific pledges, closing Guantanamo, ending the war in Iraq and what have you. But the broader campaign was about an image and a vision. Those tend to work better and handcuff you less when you're in office. So we can think of most of the successful candidates in the 20th century. You know, a lot of them are presenting big strategy ideas and a big sort of vision of what their presidency will be like, rather than a specific laundry list of promises.
You know, let's think about President Trump for a minute in this context again, which is to say, we went through the list of things that he promised. One that we neglected was he also promised to remove the United States from the Paris Climate Accord.
Which he did.
Which he did. So in terms of this promises kept mantra, it's interesting, he's failed thus far, and I suspect he'll continue to fail, to get his signature promise, which was building the wall. However, if you take this list of promises together, lock her up, build the wall, closing, sorry, withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, Supreme TPP. Court justices, TPP as well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They neatly sum up, and again, I'm not here defending President Trump's policies, but they actually, as a list, very neatly encapsulate his worldview, which certainly resonated with voters, or some voters. It resonated with his supporters and his base, which appears to be about 35% of the American electorate, but did so quite effectively. And that was very powerful for him and very effective for him when there were 20 candidates running for the nomination. And so I think the pressure on in a crowded Democratic field of people to make clear promises will be quite strong. Whether that's a good thing or not, I think you've outlined why it's probably not a good thing, but it probably will happen. I would say one other thing about promises before we wrap up, which is a lot of the people running for president are office holders, of course, and they're very prominent office holders. And Elizabeth Warren was asked when she was recently running for a re-election in Massachusetts as senator whether she's going to run for president. I can't actually remember what she said, but a lot of candidates...
Also married, she is someone related to a historian.
Yes.
Yes.
But a lot of candidates, frankly, lie to voters. A lot of people who will run for president lie to the voters before they run for president about whether they intend to run for president.
No,
because when you're running for one office and they promise not to run, and then they say circumstances have changed. I would suggest to you that actually encourages a level of cynicism that's not very good among the electorate, that's not very good for the electorate.
Well, I think there's a general supposition candidates say things that they're not going to deliver on. Right? That if you're running for Congress, your ability to actually enact anything individually is nothing.
Right.
And if you're running for president, I think most people know that the president's power is extensive but not exhaustive, and that they can promise more funding for schools or infrastructure week again, but that actually translating that into action, given the structure of the American government and the divided nature of politics today in particular, voters know when somebody says, "Vote for me, we will have a better environment, clean, whatever, we'll fight, global warming." Voters know that they're voting for somebody who will fight for that, but actually doing it requires...
That's true, but that's not quite the point I was making, David, which is I think that people promise that they're not going to run for president when they know full well they're going to. Elizabeth Warren knew she was going to run for president when she was running for Senate in Massachusetts this year, or last year. She knew it. Yeah, of course she knew it. And she's not alone. They all do this because they have to do it.
A lot of winking and nodding with politics that,
But I'm suggesting that engenders a sort of cynicism about politicians' promises.
Wait, Americans are cynical about politicians?
Well, stop the presses!
I'm thinking the news flash, right? Okay. All right, we will see what kinds of promises the Democratic candidates make in the coming months, because
David, I promise now that when you declare your candidacy, I will support you to the end. And if you don't declare your candidacy, I promise that we will continue to do this podcast throughout the election.
So wait, okay, good. I will keep you abreast of developments.
Yes,
I'm mulling the opportunity.
And if you do form an exploratory committee,
yes,
I hope I'm going to be on it.
Oh, to be sure. To be sure. And campaign donors out there listening.
We like small donors. We're like...
We like big donors, right? Come on. That's a lot of work, small donors.
You see, David's all about Wall Street. I'm a man of the people.
Hey, walls. Walls work?
Well, they're big. They're like wheels.
Oh, jeez. All right. So what's your last reference?
I have two. I need to make an apology to all of our listeners, our many millions of listeners, particularly my most loyal Scottish friends, which is the Scottish tennis player Andy Murray, announced the impending end of his career. He's been bedeviled by injuries in recent years, and he has said he's hoping to be healthy enough to play in Wimbledon this year. The Australian Open is about to start. This has nothing to do with American history, but I want to apologize at every...
He won the U.S. Open at one point.
He did, okay, yes, and he did it in the past. That's history. So I have had as my stated position throughout Andy Murray's career that I don't like him and I've always rooted against him. And this is based largely on his behavior as a very, very stroppy teenager. His on-court demeanor was terrible when he first hit the big time about 12 years ago as a 17-year-old. I've known for a while that my position was fairly absurd because Andy Murray, it turns out, is a pretty good guy. He's very good on women's rights, for example, and has been outspoken with regard to questions of feminism. Seems to be a decent person. And so I think I took again him largely because so many of my Scottish friends said, oh, you have to support him because he's Scottish. And I said, well, I'm not, so I won't. and I think he's an obnoxious teenager. Well, he's not an obnoxious adult. And I think the lesson from that is that, and I should know this as somebody who teaches university age students, that maybe we shouldn't judge people for their minor transgressions when they're teenagers. And so I am apologizing publicly and saying I actually got Andy Murray wrong. And I've quietly been rooting for him for the past few years in his career.
Those are wise words.
Well, yes. So I want to lead by example here, David.
Judging our teenagers for their youthful discretion.
Yes, exactly. And it turns out Andy Murray's a pretty good guy, and I wish him well. My second thing is I was in Galway at a conference recently, which was fabulous, in Ireland, and we heard a guy perform named Declan O'Rourke. And Declan O'Rourke is a very talented singer-songwriter. I recommend him to you strongly. He performs songs from his album, Songs of the Great Irish Famine. So there's an American in a history dimension to this because that's a thematic album which is about the famine of the 1840s. Some very, very powerful music. Go on Spotify if you have a subscription and give it a listen.
Excellent.
What about you, David?
Well, I want to endorse Michelle Obama's book, Becoming. Have you read it, Frank?
Not yet.
No, okay.
You?
Well, I am. My wife and I are reading it together, or more accurately, she's reading it aloud to me. This is the thing that we do.
Wait, start. I can't let this pass. That is incredibly sweet. So, Ida's reading Michelle Obama's Becoming to you?
Yes.
How does this operate?
She reads the words in sequence, and I listen.
Okay. I mean, how very 90. You really are a man of the 19th century. Well, so why aren't you reading it to her?
She has a better reading voice than I do, and this whole phenomenon began actually when we got the Harry Potter books back in the 10 years ago, whatever those were coming out. We didn't want to fight over who got to read the book first, so we decided to read the books aloud. On the supposition that everyone then gets the story at the same time. And then I think, as some listeners know, I've had some recurring eye problems recently, which has limited my ability to read things. And so she's been reading, we've been reading together.
That is the sweetest thing ever, David. I'm touched. How long is it taking you to get through the book?
We read a couple of chapters a night, and it's not a very long book, nor in terms of, it's not a hard, dense read. I'm not someone who generally likes these kinds of post-White House memoirs. I usually find them kind of, vacuous and telling you things you already know and having usually whitewashed bunch of things. And you can say these things in some ways about Michelle Obama's book, too. All the stories that she tells are things I've heard before. But it's well written. It tells a lot about her growing up in Chicago and what that experience was like. Talks about her experience meeting Barack and their courtship and all these other kinds of things. Stories I think they've been told in other forums too, but it's good to hear from her voice. But one of the things I'm really enjoying about the book is the way that the Obama family clearly values books and ideas and rational debate and thoughtfulness and civility that sort of speaks through every, and hard work, it sort of really speaks through every single page of the book. Not only Michelle talking about her experience, but her talking about what she sees in her husband, what she sees in her parents, what she sees in her children. Given the current political climate and the nature of public discourse at the moment, reading about the Obama White House from the inside has been a really sort of refreshing way to end the day.
Excellent. Can I just add that the Silkenats reading to each other seems to epitomize a lot of those values.
Values,
so
to be sure.
Congratulations. Yes. And anyway.
Hey, cheers.
Cheers, Dave.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.